You're listening to a journalism.co.uk podcast. My name is Alistair Reid, and it is now a year since militants from Daesh or ISIS released a video showing the murder of American journalist James Foley. 2 weeks later, fellow journalist Stephen Sotloff suffered the same fate. Foley and Sotloff were the most high-profile examples of an increasingly dangerous situation for journalists trying to document the conflicts in Syria, as journalists are no longer afforded the protection or special dispensation conflict reporters once were.
Before the Syrian civil war, for example, we didn't document at CBJ anybody being killed in Syria for years.
This is Rob Mahoney, Deputy Director of the Committee to Protect Journalists.
But since that war broke out, we know for sure that at least 84 journalists have been killed covering the conflict.
Wow.
And about half of those are freelance journalists. And then we've seen this rash of kidnappings. More than 90 journalists have been abducted since the conflict began in 2011. And we estimate that 25 are still being held. They're missing, and we presume they're being held. And some of the more high-profile ones have been the American and British journalists who were kidnapped, and of course some of them beheaded, as we saw last year. But that gives you an idea of the scale of the problem.
The 5 years since the start of the Arab Spring in 2011 have been the deadliest for journalists since the CPJ began recording deaths in 1992, with more than 800 journalists and media workers killed in that period. So why are journalists, particularly freelance conflict reporters, in greater danger now? And is anything actually being done to better protect them? Some of this is to do with the situation on the ground, said Rob, which has become much more dangerous for everyone in those areas, of course. But there are also some wider structural issues involved as well.
Well, you have a perfect storm in many ways. You have hostility from the people who journalists need to cover, like these groups. And then you have the upending of the business model of the news media, which has meant that a lot of newspapers and a lot of news organizations that used to have foreign networks of correspondents and freelancers and stringers are shrinking and are relying more and more on freelancers and independent journalists for content. And some of them, frankly, haven't been prepared to pay enough for that content to enable those journalists to take adequate safety precautions and to pay for those journalists to have proper security training and proper insurance for operating in dangerous areas. So you have these elements converging to make it very difficult for people to make a living covering conflict.
The protagonists in a lot of these conflicts in modern wars believe that they don't need journalists anymore. They have the ability to disseminate their own story or their own side of the story, their own version of events using social media. And they've become very adept at it. They've become bloody good at putting their story out. And so where journalists were protected in the past because we were needed, and I mean, people who wanted to put their story out needed journalists and needed to protect them. That has changed, and we're not needed now, and so we have become targets, because if one of us is killed or kidnapped, it generates a lot of coverage, and insurgents and fighters in any of these wars realize that they can get a lot of coverage, and so bring a spotlight onto what they're doing by targeting, kidnapping and killing Western journalists. I mean, let's be honest, they're killing a lot of other journalists as well. It's not just, oh, the poor Westerners are being targeted. You know, there's an awful lot of, you know, the local journalists are always the one that suffer the most. But by targeting and killing Western journalists, Western media outlets will cover the story, and therefore the killers are able to get their story out.
John D. McHugh, who you just heard there, has extensive experience working in conflict zones in the Middle East and recently founded Verify Media to help connect news organizations with verified journalists working in these kind of areas. In 2007, while embedded with American troops in Afghanistan, John was shot in the chest. 18 people died and 7 others were injured in the ambush.
But if somebody was looking at me through a scope, I didn't have press in the front of my body armor, but I also didn't have a weapon in my hand. I had cameras and I wasn't wearing a uniform. And because they claimed very quickly that they'd shot an Irish photographer, I had been in that area for weeks, so they knew that I was working. I mean, I could have, you know, sat with some of them at some of the meetings with the Afghans in that area. So there was no mistaking me for a combatant. I stood out like a sore thumb. And all of us are careful, or most of us are careful to do that. So the idea of having press on your body armor, you know, it's like the old idea of wearing blue body armor. There are very, very few people who wear blue body armor now, because it makes you a target.
But these conflicts do still need to be covered, and journalists, whether Western freelancers or local reporters, are still going to be entering dangerous situations to get those stories out into the wider world. Last year's murders did act as a wake-up call to the industry, though. And obviously the people directly involved in this kind of coverage were already well aware of the dangers and necessary precautions, but the wider industry realised just how dangerous this conflict can be. Back in February, a group of organisations launched the call for global safety principles and practices because, to quote the preamble to the standards, in a time of journalistic peril, news organisations and journalists must work together to protect themselves, their profession and their vital role in global society. The standards set out 7 principles and practices for freelancers and 7 for news organisations to ensure proper training, planning, payment and responsibility, and nearly 70 news organisations and unions have signed up to the standards.
And there it's laid out what are the minimum, what we regard as the minimum safety precautions necessary. Now, the big news organisations have been stepping up generally to their responsibilities towards staff for quite a while, even before the Arab uprising, because, you know, there've been instances of news people being killed or captured, whether it's in Afghanistan or before that in Sierra Leone and Liberia. So they generally train their staff, equip their staff, and insure their staff pretty well. And if you are a staff correspondent for one of those big newspapers or wire services or broadcasters, you can be pretty sure that, you know, they're going to give you the best possible care. The problem is generally for the growing numbers of freelance or independent journalists who are not staff, and there, those organizations that have signed these principles and practices pledge to give freelancers, independent contractors, as it were, the same duty of care and level of security as they would for their own staff.
There are still a number of large international news outlets who are conspicuous in their absence, however. The Frontline Freelance Register is a representative body for freelance conflict reporters and is a good breakdown of those principles and signatories. Have a look if your organisation has signed up. The Rory Peck Trust, founded in memory of journalist Rory Peck, killed in Moscow in 1993, is part of a task group to make sure these principles are adhered to. Trust Director Tina Carr fully recognises that this isn't always the case, though.
One of the things is we've got lots of examples of news organisations who are really doing what we think is the right thing, right? There's been a big improvement in the way news organisations do approach it. That's not everyone, but that's some of them.
Is that in the last 15 years or in the
recent? Yes, definitely, definitely. And even more so in the last year. But actually, and I'm not going to name names, but there are some extraordinary organisations that you would think should be taking more responsibility than they do who really aren't. So it's still the case. Therefore, you have to say, you know, freelancers need to know that it's their responsibility, that they've got to think through risks.
So any young person entering the profession for the first time and thinking that they want to cover conflict needs to go to the websites where the information that they need is available before ever they think of going to the front line. You need proper training. That means that a 4 or 5 day training course in how to cover conflict. And most importantly, in first aid, because a lot of journalists have died from injuries that might have been prevented, might have been not life threatening if someone around them had been able to administer proper first aid.
So some of those websites and resources, which, and I stress, are the first step for preparation, are the Frontline Freelance Register, the Frontline Club, the Rory Peck Trust, the Committee to Protect Journalists, and RISC, that's RISC for Reporters, Instructed and Saving Colleagues. And many of these provide bursaries and equipment loans for journalists going to these kind of areas.
It's not to be assumed that it's only the news media organisations who have to take responsibility and do it. It's freelancers themselves. I mean, we are more and more keen on making freelancers more professional and more self-sufficient. I mean, from that point of view, this is why you probably looked at our website, why we have the resources, is so that there is somewhere freelancers can go and actually say, okay, this is what I should be doing. Maybe I should think about this. Here's a download on this. I can learn about this. It's to do with doing things properly and having, not just sitting there expecting news organizations to look after you, because some will, most won't.
So knowledge is everything here. And John said he actually often spends more time planning his assignments than he actually spends on them.
When you're going into dangerous places or, you know, hostile environments, you need to have a plan, and you need to have a backup plan, and you need to have a backup plan for the backup plan. There's an old military phrase that says, amateurs talk about tactics and professionals talk about logistics. And it's absolutely true in our industry. I was making a film for Al Jazeera English, A Tale of Three Cities. So I was, you know, I could see the vast demise of the security situation in Afghanistan. And I realized that this was probably the last opportunity I would have to travel outside of Kabul with any semblance of safety. And so the plan was to go to Herat, a city in the west, and spend some time there, get out in the street, talk to some people, meet some locals, and just understand, you know, how the situation was there. Then go to a city in the north, Mazar-i-Sharif, and spend some time there. And then go to Jalalabad in the east and get out there and speak to some people. And I spent weeks planning it. And so, for example, you know, with each city, I needed to have a map of the city centre. I needed to have a map that showed, you know, where the guest house was that I was staying in. I needed to have a backup guest house so that if the one I was staying in, you know, was hit with a bomb or an attack, or it suddenly got closed down, because the authorities do that sometimes, I needed to have somewhere else to go to. I had, you know, I on those maps, I marked out where the military installations were so that if I really got in trouble and I had to make a run for it, I would know where to go. We worked out where the hospitals or the place that would provide medical aid if necessary. And the US consulate in Herat was on my map as a place of potential safety should I find myself in trouble. So an awful lot of planning goes into those trips, because if you just turn up and say, I'm just going to roll around and see what happens, well, I'll tell you what will happen, something bad.
It may seem obsessive, but even the little things can make a big difference.
I mean, that situation that I was in Jalalabad, when things went, you know, very bad very quickly, you know, when we had pulled up, my driver parked nose in to the curb. And I said to, you know, I didn't speak, he spoke Pashto, and my Pashto is terrible. So I said to my translator, my fixer, I said, can you ask him to turn the car around and park, you know, face out? So if we need to get out of here quickly, we can. And my fixer was he's a friend of mine, and he was like, oh, come on, you're always worried, you always think something bad will happen. I said, can you just do it? Can you just turn it around? Because it's just one of those systems that I have. And I, you know, I always am looking at the exit as soon as I arrive. I mean, you've sat with me, Alistair. You know, I sit with my back to a wall so I can watch the door. I can see who's coming in. You know, I know where the exits are in any pub or cafe that I go into. And that day, I insisted that we turn the car around. And then we got out of the car and went for a little walk. And a couple of minutes later, we came running back to the car, needing to get out of there very quickly, with some people coming after us. And he was able to just drive straight out because we had turned the car around. So just that one little instance, I don't know if it saved our lives, but it certainly helped us to get out of a situation that I wanted to be out of very quickly.
John's wife is his security manager. She has been since before they were married. And they have established a set of procedures and measures to make sure everything is catered for.
We have a mixture of code words. We'll speak sometimes in Irish. I do things, I have keywords, so I can say something which indicates that everything I say subsequently is a lie. So if somebody is listening, I can lay a complete false trail on where I'm going to be or what I'm going to do. We have a veiled time reference. So if I say I'm going to leave in 15 minutes, that doesn't mean I'm going to leave in 15 minutes. It means something else. I'm not being overly coy here, but I don't want to give the whole system away.
Of course.
But you know, this is, and I know some of my friends think I'm absolutely paranoid, but, you know, I'm still alive and I have been in some pretty hairy places, and I absolutely believe that these systems work.
First aid training is the last resort, and ideally you won't have to end up in the situation where it is necessary. But as Rob said earlier, many journalists would still be alive if they had proper first aid administered when they were injured. John is in no doubt that it was the first aid he received when he was shot that saved his life. And when he first got to Afghanistan, he would take any chance he got to spend time with the army medics and ask them to teach him what they know.
So the American soldiers all complete a course, a combat lifesaver course. So, you know, battlefield first aid. And I've done this course with them several times now. So, you know, if during, you know, if we're sitting having coffee and you choke on a peanut, I can't do much for you. But if you get a gunshot wound or a blast amputation, I know what to do to try and preserve your life.
In the event that something does happen, freelancers absolutely have to have insurance, and at the very least medical insurance, to ensure that costs are covered and treatment can be given without any delay. So, hostile environment training, first aid, insurance, planning and communication strategies, and a regular point of contact are all vital. But updated information about the area you're travelling to is just as important, says Rob.
As I say, one of the most important things to do is to talk to people who have been to the area where you want to go, because situation changes, in some cases, hour by hour, but certainly day by day and week by week. And, you know, advice that you might have got last week might not be valid this week. In the end, there are enough good people out there that you can get the information that you need. And one of the biggest sources of information for journalists, it's always been the case, is other journalists. You just talk to people who've done it, who've been there, and who have some experience, and they'll put you straight pretty quickly.
Now, in his work at Verify Media, John actually spends a lot of time working with young journalists who are going to these kind of areas and mentoring them in their safety where necessary.
You know, I had somebody in Ukraine recently who was messaging me late one night to say that he was going to go somewhere else and meet some people the next day. And it was quite late when I got the message. And I was like, whoa, hang on a second. Whoa, who are these people? How did you meet them? Who's your contact? What's your relation to the contact? How did you meet your contact? And then very quickly went through, you know, do you have a security plan? Do you have a call-in plan? And he ended up using me as his security manager. So I was the one that was being, you know, called. And he basically would set times that he had to get in touch with me and let me know everything was okay. But that meant I had to get contact details for his family and his, you know, his next of kin, should anything happen. And, you know, I said, I need copies of your, you know, your passport and your visa, you know, other identity documents, travel documents. Because, you know, if somebody goes missing, then suddenly they're out of the picture, so they can't provide any of that. So everything needs to be provided beforehand. And this is the process that I've gone through for years.
And this is the kind of support which too often news organisations don't provide, and the reason why the global standards were established. When John was working on The Tale of Three Cities, he was lucky enough to have a commissioning editor who was looking after his safety.
And I called Dermot and said, listen, mate, I'm really sorry, but this might be a tale of two cities because I don't think I can get out. I'd had some problems on the street and I said, I don't think I can actually achieve anything here. There's so much animosity. And the first thing he said is, can you get back to Kabul tonight? So he didn't think about the film or how we could salvage it or anything else. He wanted to know if I could get out of there straight away. So I've been very lucky to work with good people. But in the wider industry, and particularly in sort of the new digital, the digital native field, a lot of people are playing very fast and loose. We're playing very fast and loose. You know, this whole desire for gonzo journalism and people standing in the middle of a riot, filming themselves saying, you know, it's all kicking off here and, you know, it's pretty crazy right now. And, oh, they're just shooting at the crowd again. That kind of journalism, that kind of approach was putting very young, inexperienced journalists into very dangerous situations. And there were also very young editors who had probably, I won't say probably, I would say categorically had never been in really difficult situations.
This may come down to naivety, maybe, but when lives are on the line, that is no excuse. The situation is different for news organisations now, admittedly, as we spend an awful lot of time discussing here at journalism.co.uk. But the last thing that can be scrimped on is safety.
There needs to be a realisation on both sides. The news organisations are not villains. They're trying to do a very, very difficult job in an area where they're working with, you know, new financial situations, new world, unpredictable situations. The whole ball game has changed for them. Things are happening that are making them leaner and hungrier, more reliant on freelancers, wanting freelancers to do more, not necessarily paying them more or looking after them more. So they just need to look at how they work with independent freelance journalists and fixers too. I do include fixers all the time, how they do work with them. And they don't, they should just be careful that insurance is somehow covered. So that if somebody is working for them even for half a day and gets into some kind of difficulty during that period when they're working for them, that is their responsibility and they should help.
The biggest problem for freelancers, whether they are working in conflict zones or not, has always, always, always been getting paid on time. And when journalists are working in dangerous areas and are known to be a target for aggressive groups in that area, slow payment can make a huge difference to their safety.
Guest houses with proper bloody blast walls and security guards cost money. Body armour costs money. Insurance costs money. First aid kits and the skills to use them, the hostile environment course, cost money. Fixers, translators, drivers, these all cost money. And freelancers in the field who have not been paid or are not being paid properly are constantly trading and trading off risk versus return and will sooner or later make a decision based on the fact that they don't have enough money to pay for something and take risks. And most of that comes from the fact that they're not being paid properly and they're not being paid quickly. If I'm in Afghanistan and I'm short of money, but I want to stay for a few extra days because I've got an interview lined up with a Taliban spokesman, but you know I can't meet him for a few days, so I have to stay. I'm running out of money. You know, I've got to pay for my guest house, got to pay for my driver, and you know, you're in a situation where you say, well, how am I going to do this? I haven't got enough money, but I didn't want to stay for this. So you end up moving to a cheaper guest house, but it doesn't have security guards. So now you risk, you know, an attack some night, or you say, I'm not going to use my usual driver because I just can't afford him. So I'll take one of the local taxis, but you know, that can get you into a whole lot of trouble. So yes, when you're short of money, decisions are affected by that. And when you're in a pretty dangerous place, those decisions can get you in trouble very quickly. And I just don't believe in this day and age that it's acceptable to pay people so slowly. And as I say, we don't do it. We pay people in 7 days and we're a tiny little new agency. If we can do it, everybody else can do it.
Ultimately, though, the situation is improving. Anyone working in international news of any kind should read and adhere to the Global Call for Standards. Now, that is beyond doubt. But organisations like the CPJ and the Roy Peck Trust and others are all working to spread those standards and educate journalists in the reality of the situation. But this change and improvement will only happen if both freelancers and news organisations make the effort to protect themselves and each other in a new and changing world of news.
I think that journalists themselves, freelancers themselves, will, if they are paid properly, if they have the money coming from the people that commission them for their work, will make sure that they have the correct equipment and the correct training, because it's after all, it's their lives that are on the line when they deploy. And so there has been, I would say, at the very least, a huge increase in awareness of the dangers that journalists face, and a lot more resources out there for those journalists to better prepare themselves for what is a very dangerous business.
You've been listening to a journalism.co.uk podcast.